This episode is sponsored in part by Thousand Eyes. Thousand Eyes gives you visibility, insights, and actionable intelligence into user experience from every user to every application over any network. So you transform your WAN, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experiences in the cloud and on premises. Try Thousand Eyes for free at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and snag a fun t-shirt. Thousand Eyes. Thrive in a connected world.
Cumulus Networks is one of our sponsors for today's episode. Thank them for being a part of the Packet Pushers community by downloading their white paper on transitioning to 100 gig Ethernet. Do that at cumulusnetworks.com/100gpod. That's cumulusnetworks.com/100gpod. That would be really cool of you. Welcome to Packet Pushers, a weekly show where we talk about all things data networking. It is just Ethan, Greg, and Drew today. You know our voices, you know us. And in this show, we're going to hit some housekeeping stuff. We're going to talk to you about Ignition. We're going to talk about the brandy new IPv6 Buzz podcast, our impressions of VMworld and FutureNet a little bit. And then some personal things that we're going to talk about. Now, don't get nervous, like, oh my gosh, there's like you guys leaving. No, just relax. It's a personal stuff about staying healthy and emotional health and our mental health and how we deal with that as it's a journey that we've been on. Because, hey, we're all on a journey here in IT, right? Yeah, okay. So starting out with housekeeping, some housekeeping issues. All right, so if you're a Packet Pushers fan and you've been following us for a long time, you know that web hosting has been a great joy for us over the years. Has it not, Greg? A great joy indeed.
Oh, dear, dear. We thought we had it solved back in 2014 when we migrated onto a managed service, if you will, on outsourcing. And as always, outsourcing shows that it sucks.
So
quite honestly.
We didn't take our own advice.
No. Well, in 2014, Packet Pushers was very different. Ethan and I were really struggling for time. We both had full-time jobs, and managing the physical website hosting was just incredibly painful. And it was actually in 2014 we knew we wanted to do the membership system. And so we moved over to a hosted service which promised to build a membership platform that sounded great. It was compatible with our plugins. It was all the things that we wanted, and it was being done by people that we had trusted up until that point. And basically in the last 4 years, they've delivered none of the promises. They lied through their teeth.
Not a one.
Not a one.
Well, I'm guessing they didn't get much market momentum behind the hosting platform that they created. And just roughly decided, we're going to abandon this thing. Well, that's more or less the letter we got not all that long ago saying, hey, we're shutting this down over time. Time to move, guys.
They did some interesting, from the outside, they did some really dumb stuff. And you just sort of saw the site. Anyway, the answer is the membership system there was so bad that we couldn't actually put it together between 2015, 16, 17. And we finally got it together in 2017 when we spawned it off into a completely different site. So we just abandoned the whole membership platform they gave us, and that's, of course, is Ignition.
That's not what we abandoned, right?
But we abandoned the old site that we built.
It's on a platform that we own. And then we also – so this site was the original – site here was packetpushers.net. We've moved that off to our own hosting infrastructure and our own platform now. We're working with a web developer and someone who's got some very strong backend infrastructure experience who's helping us tweak it and get it just right. Now, all right, so we did that. We got it moved. That happened in early August. And we had some pain along the way with RSS feeds and stability and a few other things that have now all been settled. Everything's we think is good, and we also got SSL and IPv6 for everyone, so there's a Quad A record out there now.
Technically, Mr. Banks, I have to correct you there, it's actually TLS.
Well, yes, aren't you right? Aren't you exactly correct?
Pedantic mode on!
But those are things that people have been asking for, certainly, as well, so we're very happy to be a company that talks a lot about security and about things like IPv6 adoption and are now finally on our own platform having these things under our control and are able to offer those services as they should be. RSS, one issue that remains is some of you discover the show and you want to go all the way back to the beginning or at least go pretty deep into the archives, and we're not publishing every single show we've ever done on the RSS feeds at the moment. That had to do with load on the server. That had to do with the size of the RSS feeds as you get into, as we have several hundred shows, the size of the RSS feed can become a problem and put a load on the server. And we're working on figuring that out, how exactly we're going to make all of the back catalogs easily accessible to you in your podcatcher. And we have some ideas there. We just haven't nailed down exactly how to do it yet. So our apologies if you're one of the several people that wrote to us and said, hey, I'm trying to get to some old show and I can't get to it. How do I do that? We're working on it.
So a couple of things that we learned from that. One, when I didn't really think about this at the time, but what became clear is because we were publishing the latest 100 shows in the podcast feed with the full content, so that is the entire blog post is actually embedded in the XML, the RSS XML. So that means the actual size of that file was getting up towards 4 or 5 megabytes. And so when your smartphone is probably reaching out to get an updated version to check if there's any new shows, you're actually downloading quite a lot of bandwidth. And so part of the logic here is I want to save people's battery and bandwidth by clocking it back. And that's why we're now only publishing the last 30. If that's a problem, then email us, packetpushers@gmail.com, and let us know, because I can increase it back up. I'm not willing to go back up to 100, I think, because that would be unfair for some people, especially people in countries. I mean, we publish the MP3 files in 96 kilobit per second mono so that the files are quite small. They're all 20 to 50 megs max, so usually around 25, 30. And we do that to save your bandwidth. And I didn't actually twig that the XML file was actually – you're probably downloading more data and checking the latest XMLs.
So, and if you do want old shows, you can still go to the website, packetpushers.net, and go to the appropriate show page. And we have all the shows there. You can download them. You can listen to them on your computer. So they are there. Yeah. They just may not be easily available in RSS.
Yes, and that.
Now, one idea that we've got as far as how to make the old shows available, we had thought, you know, if we just make a RSS feed that's, here's all the shows from 2014, and then another RSS feed, here's all the shows from 2015, and so on. Maybe you could dive in that way year by year and get the old catalog. That is an option for us. If you like that idea, let us know that as well. We'd appreciate your feedback or clever thoughts if you've got some interesting idea.
Maybe we could just start it. Maybe we could just start at 2016, 2017, and just go from there, perhaps.
So we'll see.
Yep. So that was one thing. Obviously, because we use WordPress for all of our hosting, the load on the hosting side is actually quite substantial. We've now resolved all of that. You can't cache XML RSS feed requests. And the second part was that there was a change in the file request. So the previous site had a particular way that it, when you recorded the podcasts, it had a particular request format which bounced it off the raw, sent it to the home site before it redirected off somewhere else. And that's why a lot of you had problems. It's just something we couldn't do anything about. We tried really, really hard, but it was really quite difficult to get it fixed. And it turns out that this wasn't an issue that anybody picked up. So we are now back to self-hosting, and that means we are in control, which is the main thing.
And in the early days of the site, Greg, or the site migration, I know it went from 80-something percent utilization, and now with all of the tweaks and changes, and it's all settled back down to a much more normal-looking usage profile on our CPU.
Yes, so it's down to below 10%. So it dropped from 80 to 100% at the start of the migration, and we got it down to under 10%. So we've still got some work to do to stabilize it. We're still getting hammered by a lot of SEO bots and spiders. So I'm still in sort of firefighting mode to keep that up. And we've got some SEO problems where some of the stuff on the site in the migration seems to have been corrupted. So we're still working on that. But we'll get those issues fixed, sorted out in the near future. It's very time intensive. Diagnosing these things is very time intensive. And then getting them fixed, I don't have time to do that. So we have to escalate them out to a third party.
Now, if you're listening to that and went, I don't know why you think I care about that. Well, you're nerds, and like we're nerds, and so we thought you might care about the back-end details of what it takes to keep Packet Pushers up and running these days, since it's gone from something, well, Greg, you and I and Dan way back in the day kind of started for fun and turned into this whole thing. Yeah. All right, Ignition. So let's move on to the Ignition commentary. We launched ignition.packetpushers.net. That is the membership site. So originally, we were going to have it membership be a part of the main packetpushers.net. We decided to separate it, launch it on its own platform, which is Ignition. That's been running now for a while. We have a lot of you have signed up. to be premium members at $99 a year and gain access to what we've been putting in there. So there's free content, there's premium content. It's been going well, and we are beginning to add more and more content. So a few things about that. One is the Virtual Design Clinic videos. We did our VDC 1, Virtual Design Clinic 1, back in March. All of those videos are there, and you don't have to pay to get access to those. That is freely available to you as a free member on Ignition. Just run on up there and get all of that. Greg has also been doing some more videos. We've been writing content and publishing some articles in there. And we have more Virtual Design Clinic videos that are coming. We've got two new Virtual Design Clinic events we've put on the calendar. We'll be making formal announcements about those pretty soon, but there's going to be one in October and then one in December, just in time for the holidays. We're thinking of wearing little Christmas hats. And you can see those Virtual Design Clinic videos will be published to Ignition when we are done running those events and then editing up the videos so that they can be consumed by you. I'm also working on courses. I finally, before August took over my life with travel, I began publishing QoS fundamentals videos in a course format, so you can sit and learn about QoS at a deeper level. Now, I had someone on LinkedIn ask me, well, what does that content look like? What is a QoS course from you looking like? It is me. Imagine if you could just sit with me and get all my thoughts on QoS and in like in a napkin format. You know, we're sitting together, we're having a chat, we're eating some good chicken wings maybe and having a nice beer, and we're talking through QoS like from a design format. You have a challenge at work maybe, and you need to understand all the different QoS tools and where they fit to solve the problem that you've got. That's what I'm doing. It's me chatting with you, and then it's a screen capture of my iPad as I'm drawing things in real time, talking to you. It's as close as I could get to being in a classroom with a whiteboard, which is really how I like to present. I don't have a lot of slides. It's really all real time as I'm talking with you. And I'm going to be recording and producing more of the videos for that course in this month, which at this moment is September 2018. So we've got, again, a lot of content. Finally, we're getting the mill cranked up and going into Ignition. And, you know, at $99 a year, we're hoping that really any one bit of content that's in there is going to be appealing to you and you'll sign up. We didn't price it super high. We wanted to make it accessible for everyone as a way that you can support us no matter what content is in there. Or maybe there is premium content that looks really exciting to you. You can go and get it without a big expense from your pocket.
And something to preview that I'm working on, putting together kind of a buyer's guide or an information guide on network operating systems. There's a lot of them out there. They all have their little subtle differences. So we've put together a list of questions we're going to send out to as many folks in the network operating system space as will accept it and fill it out and return it to us. And then we'll package that up and make it available on Ignition. And we'll also do a little bit of writing up front to provide some basic context around network operating systems, the value proposition, and some things to look out for. But that's also coming in Ignition.
And Drew, you've got an SD-WAN report in there as well?
Yeah, I wrote an SD-WAN report based on an audience survey we did. So this is your peers out there who are using SD-WAN or thinking about SD-WAN. So that report is up there. That's, you know, 8 or 9 pages. It's got some good diagrams of the report responses we got, the survey responses we got. And it's, again, a general sort of overview of the technology and some gotchas, and also just where folks are getting the technology from. So interesting stuff.
And then, Greg, your ebook on career is in there. And I know we've gotten some feedback from that. Some folks have downloaded mm-hmm. those PDFs, read them, and actually it has made a difference in how they're interacting with their employer.
Yeah. Somebody, a couple of people tell me that it's given them pause to think. Now, it's not the most polished book I'll ever write. And I'm planning to rewrite it again next year to put more information in it. But the basic core of it is there. I want to challenge you to understand your value to the employer. Now, what I've also done to supplement that, as I've sat down with Peyton Maynard Curran, who you'll know from other podcasts, and we've recorded a 4-part podcast on that, and that will publish up to the site shortly, where we actually dig into the book is in 4 parts, and we sort of briefly talk over each of the 4 points in a conversation format. And Peyton is adding his own suggestions and his own dialogue around that. So if you actually want the book summarized as it's not an audio book, it's not a reading of the book per se, because the book actually contains a lot of data and a lot of suggestions. But if you don't have time to read the book, it's not that long, to be fair. It's only 20,000 words, so it's 4,000 or 5,000 words, so it's really only a couple of hours reading at most. But you can actually listen. There'll be podcasts there that you can listen to. Unfortunately, they won't go into a feed because they're part of the membership system. The membership system is there to organize content, not to track you or follow you. So just don't get the wrong idea about the membership system. It allows us to group content together according to you as a person. So you can favorite content and add it and save it. And that's what it's for. It's not there to track you or follow you or sell your data to anybody.
So speaking of that, that's exactly right. There is no privacy. We don't trade on your account information in Ignition with anyone on that site or on packetpushers.net. That's just a fundamental way we do business. We never tell anybody who you individually are. But as far as feeds go on Ignition, it's been on my to-do list to make those happen. And I'm going to be getting RSS feeds done in some way. I got some homework to do to sort out exactly how to make that happen. But that's, I'm planning on that because some of you have said, hey, the way I'm going to want to consume, the way I'm going to want to be notified that something new is on Ignition isn't logging into the website every day to see if there's something new, but to have it show up in my Feedly or whatever tool you use to consume RSS. So we're aware of that. It's on my list. And I got the tools. I just got to sit and do a little experiment and make it happen.
Let's pause the podcast for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, Thousand Eyes. Like it or not, your organization is embracing the cloud, and that might be great for the business, but for network architects and IT ops teams, it can be a service delivery nightmare. Why? Well, you're depending on cloud providers, ISPs, and third-party apps for business-critical services. And even though you don't control those networks, you do own the service delivery, which means if performance is bad, people are going to come looking for you. And this is where ThousandEyes can help. You can take advantage of ThousandEyes agents across the cloud, within your enterprise, all the way down to the endpoint. These agents actively monitor network behavior and topologies and how they affect application performance. With ThousandEyes, you can correlate multiple layers of performance data from L2 to L7, including BGP routing and DNS, to quickly identify problem areas and dramatically reduce your mean time to repair. You can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. And you don't have to keep all this intelligence to yourself. You can easily share events, metrics, and dashboards with your vendors and customers so that you can collaborate to resolve problems faster. Now, ThousandEyes also aggregates anonymized, real-time data from a collective data set so they can generate insights about large-scale issues across the internet, including their severity and breadth, as well as likely root cause. Now, if all that sounds good to you, here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Try ThousandEyes for free at ThousandEyes.com/PacketPushers. And while you're there, get yourself a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. That's ThousandEyes.com/PacketPushers. Manage every network like it's your own. ThousandEyes. Thrive in a connected world. And now, back to the podcast.
Okay, next topic here for us is we have a brand new podcast, IPv6 Buzz. Now, three guys who have made their career, not exclusively on IPv6 by any means, but certainly they are most well known in the industry for their IPv6 expertise, have joined together and are publishing their knowledge about IPv6 along with a lot of industry experts on the Packet Pushers Network. IPv6 Buzz is Ed Horley, Tom Coffeen, and Scott Hoag. And Drew, you've been working with these guys a lot and helping them publish the shows. Thoughts so far?
Yeah, so they came to us. Our policy generally with new podcasts is we'll give you a tryout in the community channel. We want to see you put together 10 podcasts before we graduate you to the main feed. Because doing a podcast is actually a lot harder than it sounds. There's actually a lot of work and preparation that goes into it. So we have that sort of 10 podcast rule to make sure folks are actually committed. These guys rolled up with a spreadsheet of 30 podcast ideas on IPv6. And I was like, okay, I'm thinking this is going to be a graduate one. So they've done 7 or 8 now, and we decided they're doing great. The content is good. They sound very polished. Their audio quality is high. The content quality is high. They get very deep, very nerdy on IPv6. Across a range of ideas, they're talking about security, they're talking about networking, they're talking about IPv6 rollouts in telcos, in service providers, in colleges and universities. And that's just the few shows they've done so far, and there's a lot more to talk about IPv6. So I'm really impressed with the show so far to date, and if you are interested in IPv6 for your work, it's going to affect networking, obviously, then check it out.
Because heaven knows I'm not.
I mean, honestly, I'm glad these guys are so into it because it's important. It's very complex. There's a lot that still needs to be done with IPv6. So it's great to have them diving in and really noticing the details and explaining the details to everybody else.
Well, I think the amazing thing about this is these three people, Ed, Tom, and Scott, have actually been involved with IPv6 for over 15 years.
That's
and
right.
Have actually been drafting standards, running education programs, consulting with large companies, and I mean very large companies, on non-IPv6. So these people know stuff about IPv6 that I didn't even know I needed to know. And really, I listen to the shows to actually – I learn a lot about IPv6. So if you want to get into that and start tracking it, that's a pretty good way to stay up, because so much about IPv6 is still evolving, in my opinion. The problem with IPv6 is it's not finished. Now, IPv4 is pretty much finished, and that makes it easy to deploy, and that's my problem with IPv6. And we're still not seeing – for enterprise IT, which is where I like to focus, I don't like to get into carriers. I know carriers can do IPv6 and mobile phones do IPv6. Yeah, oh, fine, but the reality is that a lot of stuff we do in the enterprise still isn't IPv6, like management platforms and firewalls, for example, or IDS engines just don't do, you know, and even if they do IPv6 in the data plane, they don't do IPv6 on the management interface or something like that, right? So that's the sort of thing. These guys really go into it in a lot of detail and speak from just this wealth of experience, which is really just fantastic.
And if you're thinking, I work in an enterprise and we have no interest in IPv6, well, one of the points of this show is that it's actually finally and for reals getting to that point in the enterprise where you do need it because of certain resources on the internet now that are only available or only published via IPv6. And so even though that's a small amount, it is becoming increasingly true that you are cutting yourself off from parts of the internet if you don't have some kind of an IPv6 strategy. And all they want to do, Ed, Tom, and Scott here, is educate you on how to get there and what that means and encourage adoption. It's not as hard as it was, even though there is complexity to it and it's something to be taken seriously. So again, the IPv6 Buzz podcast, how do you get it? Well, there's a few ways. One, go into your podcatcher. You can search for Packet Pushers. It's one of the feeds there. Search for IPv6 Buzz. It should come up that way as well. It is also in our full feed, Greg. Is that correct? I believe it's hitting that one too.
The full feed, yep.
Okay, so a lot of shows out there already. Mm-hmm. They're getting thousands of downloads per show already and good feedback. So
yeah, it's been in iTunes for a few weeks now, so it should have propagated out to all the podcatchers out there. If you do find one that isn't, like Stitcher or one of these other strange ones, let me know. Send us an email to packetpushers@gmail.com, and we'll go and do the necessary to make sure it's on those platforms. Most of those platforms actually pull the podcast from iTunes, the information. That's how they find new podcasts, so it's not normally something we have to do, but every now and then we do.
And just a note on Cadence, we're running IPv6 Buzz every 2 weeks, so it's a bi-weekly show. So we're hoping not to overwhelm you with IPv6, but enough to keep you interested in coming back.
Okay, VMworld and FutureNet. VMworld 2018, and then within the VMworld 2018 conference, the mini conference called FutureNet. We attended, all of the Packet Pushers were at VMworld, and then Greg and I were able to hang around the day, the last day of the conference for the FutureNet event, and had a few impressions. Now, Greg and Drew, I know you guys talked about VMworld in Network Break 200 already. So I don't want to, you know, belabor that, but just a few comments here. One thing is we had some fun. We got ourselves video cameras and a wireless microphone rig and went out on the VMworld show floor. And I think we shot about 25 different videos, and we're in the process of editing those and uploading them to our YouTube channel. So if you didn't know that we had a YouTube channel, go up to youtube.com, search for Packet Pushers. Our channel will come up, and you can see all the things that we've been putting in there for quite a while now. I know we have over 2,000 subscribers on that channel in its early days, and those VMworld videos are going to be up there where we go to the show floor, we talk to interesting vendors, some people you know, some people you don't, and ask them about what's going on. One personal highlight for me was running into the founder of NanoVMs. They are working with an infrastructure to deploy and manage unikernels, which is a personally interesting topic of mine that we've talked about on the DataKnot show quite a bit. And there's a lot of other videos that we put up there. So that's one thing we did and had a lot of fun shooting those. And Drew, we also had some fun making mistakes. We had two cameras, so we'd have one camera that was on a stand, right, shooting at the interviewer and interviewee. And then we had the second camera that was handheld. We'd go around and try to get these other shots so it would make the video more interesting, right?
Yeah.
And Drew and I both made the mistake of getting in the frame in the background with our second camera. Oops, here and there.
So you may spot a few gaffes. It's our first time playing around video. But
hey, but it turned up all right. It came out.
It really did. Yeah.
It really did. Like, it's not our usual sort of hour-long deep dive, you know, trawl through. It is 2 minutes. We're aiming at 2 minutes. But what we do is we called it on the spot, because what we did is basically ask these people questions on the spot. God, I'm so imaginative. I'm so creative. Deep down inside.
You are, buddy. You are. It's not two beer networking, but you know.
It's not two beer networking. I know people do. It's pretty. Two beer networking is pretty popular.
It's not great for your liver, but it's very popular.
Yeah, well, lots of people said that to us as we were walking around VMware that, you know, they really thought 2-beer networking was pretty good. But unfortunately, the impact of 2-beer networking is I don't get a lot of work done because it means going to the pub on a Monday or a Tuesday when the bar is quiet because people get a bit freaked when you set up a camera rig and start talking to it in the middle of a bar. Mm-hmm. And of course, once you have a couple of beers at lunchtime, that's it. There's really not much work getting done after that. So unless I can find a better way of doing it, I don't know. But if anybody's ever in the UK and you're near my neck of the woods, which is in the Midlands in Gloucestershire, give me a hoy. We can make that happen.
And just so you know, these videos that we shot at VMworld were done entirely sober, at least for me. I don't know about you two if you had a little snore before we went on the floor, but I had not had imbibed anything other than tea and coffee.
Completely sober. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Although, had we done a 2-beer networking at VMworld, that could have been interesting. Mm. Mm. Certainly, we were in Vegas. It's not like it would have been out of character. Anyway.
Yeah, the trouble with Vegas is noise. It's so noisy there. It's really hard to record stuff.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to mention is that we kept these videos short on purpose, 2 to 3 minutes, and you guys got some high-quality mics, so the sound is actually really good, even though we're on a noisy show floor. So you can actually hear what people are saying without you pick up a little bit of the show floor background, but it's the audio is really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mic was startlingly good. We were very concerned about that. Are we going to be able to hear the person we're interviewing over the background noise of the show floor? And the microphone we ended up with, which was a Rode microphone. I forgot the model name, but
News Shooter.
That was part of the, I think that might have been the kit. I don't remember.
You're giving away the secrets. You're giving away the secrets.
Well, they can see, they can tell exactly what it is. It's right there on the video. It ain't rocket science, but... But that mic did a lovely, lovely job, and to the point of we were somewhat awestruck by how suppressed the noise floor was compared to.
Remember when we shot the first video and then we plugged it in and I ran it through Final Cut and then did a bit of a audio munge, and I was going like, I can actually hear it. It's awesome.
We were really happy and didn't
sharing
didn't
the headphones around, going like,
it's good stuff. All right, Greg, so we were also at FutureNet. Now, again, if you're missing the context here, VMworld happens, and then FutureNet is a one-day event that happens at the tail end of VMworld on the Thursday of the week. It was an invitation-only event, the big idea of which is bring in a bunch of people to do talks about the future of networking, what's advanced, what's leading edge, what's coming up, what's next, new, interesting, and let's have those talks. Let's have those presentations. And it was sort of a rapid-fire format. The day wasn't overly long. I think it started at 9 in the morning with Greg and I on stage and Drew with a roving microphone doing sort of a breakfast podcast, and you're actually going to hear that as a Priority Queue episode coming up soon. We did a live recording there with Guido Appenzeller and Bruce Davey. They are executives within the networking world of VMware and have lots and lots of insight based on what they're talking about with their customers and as far as what the future of networking looks like. And we just went rapid fire style through a whole bunch of different questions and even were able to, with the roving mic, bring in someone from the audience to chat a bit and at times contradict what Bruce and Guido were saying, somewhat as you do when you get in the executive ranks and you're on stage, tend to present the best light on things. But the best light isn't always the most accurate.
I think it's the version of the world that they see or would like to see. And it's like I tweeted something out today, and Oracle had a picture, had a banner up at a conference which said blockchain, AI, machine learning, blockchain, IoT, Oracle Cloud, all on one banner. And that's like none of the things that Oracle does today, but maybe they will eventually. You know, like they're working really hard to do all of those things because if they don't, they're going to be dead. But right now it's like bingo. It's just literally buzzword bingo. And sometimes executives get out there and their job is to talk about stuff. So we did sort of pull them down to reality in some cases.
A little bit.
Not in a bad way, in a positive way.
No, it was actually a great conversation because both of those guys are not, they're not egomaniacs who just insist that their way is the only way and you will believe the vision. You will believe. It's not that at all. And therefore, and we've been able to interview them several times over the years, Greg, both of these gentlemen. And so we had just a good breakfast chat that seemed to come out fairly well. And again, you're going to be able to hear that discussion cool. on Priority Queue. That was the beginning of FutureNet. And from there, we moved into a much bigger ballroom and listened to, again, sort of a rapid-fire format of presentations made by several people from a variety of different companies like Google and... and on the list goes
LinkedIn. Yeah, it was an interesting mix.
SnapRoute was there.
Yeah. It was an interesting mix of companies. There was some of the big fangs were there talking about. So LinkedIn and Google were talking about their use. Service Mesh was the big thing of the day, particularly.
Oh boy.
Yeah. I thought it was like the Quarry Angels had come down. The tablets are there with Istio and Service Mesh written on the front of it, and everything's an API driven future. And and it's like, really, you're gonna go there? Like Istio really has only been around for a year or two, and we've got like a half a dozen people all singing the praises of Istio. Well, color
Istio
me.
Just got to 1.0. It just got to 1.0. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Now, having said that. Everybody who's anybody seems to be worshipping at the altar of Service Mesh right about now. And I do think, I'm not 100% sure yet whether it's a timeless black suit, with a gentle, nice pinstripe that's going to last you for several years, or whether it's a Hawaiian shirt that really should just be chucked in the bin. I'm not 100% sure. But there are a lot of people throwing a lot of money at it and giving it a lot of time, a lot of airtime and a lot of focus. So Google, when I was at the Google Next conference about 6 weeks ago, they had developed a whole product set around it. And I think in a public cloud, Service Mesh makes perfect sense because you don't get network visibility in a public cloud. You just lose track. And in a microservices environment where your microservices are talking to other microservices and different people are doing different things, you just lose track of what's actually happening. And so Service Mesh is a way of using the network to track what the microservices are doing without actually looking at the microservices themselves, which is a very microservices way. You just assume that microservices are working the way they are.
I mean, there's a lot to that discussion, Greg. I mean, I think Service Mesh is, if you're trying to compare it to something, a lot of you are running load balancing services of some kind. You've got a load balancer with a virtual IP pool members behind it, and the load balancer does the magic and the translations. Service Mesh is a significant evolution of that model, driven in part by microservice architectures with ephemeral infrastructure where containers are coming and going, et cetera, and needing to be able to manage and push load across those devices and still track it and still provide a lot of other services such as encapsulation and encryption in a trackable way, as you were saying. So we've done content on Service Meshes on Packet Pushers before. So if you are trying to dig in and find out more, we just did a show on Istio and Envoy, which is a sidecar proxy that Istio can manage on Datanauts. That's a very recent Datanauts episode. We've done a show with Avi Networks. Avi Networks has been on, and their architecture also can be deployed as a Service Mesh.
It's very Service Mesh-like. Yeah, their architecture is sort of microservices focused. I think the thing about a Service Mesh itself is that the actual agent that sits in line, the actual service proxy, can be a load balancer. It can actually do rate control, but it rate controls at the API level, not at the packet level, right? Or not at the – so it's not just a HTTP request. It's actually at the API level. How many APIs can I sustain? It can map outages. So if the service, the microservice behind it goes out, do I need to redirect the service away? It can do SSL termination. So if I need to decrypt it to do inspection, so then I get security, I get logging, I get request logging if that's what I need. So really everything that you used to do with a load balancer, but in a very distributed multi-service sort of a way, that's what Istio is heading to. It's very difficult to nail down what Istio is because it's going to be different. Sorry, a Service Mesh is because it's going to be different for very different people.
The way I think of it is containers came along and they're ephemeral, they can come and go, and so we needed something like Kubernetes to be that element of persistence that's also doing the orchestration for the containers. Service Meshes, Istio, Envoy, I feel like those are the elements of persistence for the networking, for the load balancing, for the monitoring and management that you want in a container-based or microservices architecture.
I always thought of it as feedback loops. Everything, like all the DevOps people deploy a container, but they don't know if it was deployed or whether the services or traffic's flowing to it.
Right.
And you have to have a feedback loop to say, is it working? Is it working as I thought it was? And in normal networks, we do packet sniffing, we do spanning ports. We can do, there are various things that we can do, or run it through a load balancer, physical load balancer, or a physical proxy device of some sort. But in a cloud environment, you've got no physical network. You can't go in and tap it. You can't follow the cables to see where it's plugged in. You can't, you know, put a sniffer on that port and see what it's talking to analyze it. So you need something in a cloud environment. The question I have in my mind is, this is very new, and a lot of these people are jumping on Istio to solve a developer problem. So developers have the problem. Developers have developed a networking problem. And the concern I have is, when developers solve problems, they solve them quite often the wrong way, right? Like, look at what's happened over the last 20 years. Infrastructure has been basically patching bad software development practices. And I just wonder, just have this sinking feeling that, and I can see why Istio exists, but I can't help but feel that it might not be the long-term solution. This has got a sense of, this is the right idea. Oh, no, that didn't work so well. We didn't. So I wouldn't rush into service mesh unless you can afford to pull it back out. That's one thing. One of the other sessions, did you see the session on RSocket, Reactive Cloud Native Networking, where the person was actually saying, he actually stood up and said, networking is broken and I'm here to fix it. Well, that got my, that hit my hello idiot button. All right. You don't stand up in front of a bunch of like quite experienced networking people and tell them the network's broken. That's a really dumb thing to do.
Asking for a fight.
Yeah. And interestingly, he's going on about how, you know, we're rewriting the TCP stack to make it flow control and make it API aware, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going like, yeah, but there's 30 other companies that do exactly what you do. Some of them do it in the TCP layer. Some of them do it at the HTTP layer. This guy is going on like the world was reinvented by his organization and he could reimagine, you know, and he's talking about putting this code and you can get a JavaScript and a Python and it's all there and this, and we work around all the, I'm going like, dude, this problem's been solved. I mean,
it's not a company so much as it is an open source project. Yeah, there's rsocket.io and there's a bunch of code there. And it was interesting. It wasn't entirely clear to me at the end of the day how many people really needed this to resolve issues. It was, again, as you said, Greg, rewriting the TCP stack is like, holy crap, how many times have we done that over the last few years between Google projects and on.
Well, they were rewriting it above that at the layer six inside of the NIC, right? The network driver, fundamentally, they were doing stuff there to get around it. And I'm going like, there's a reason why that has never been done, and that's because it's stupid. Right? Nobody, I don't know. If it was going to work, it would have been done by now. Now, I'm not opposed to the trying, but there's some things that you look at and you go like, if you're going to start up the discussion and say, yeah, we all know that's a problem, but, you know, networking is broken and I'm here to fix it, that's just going to offside lots of people, if you know what I mean.
Interesting idea, though, and you can go up to GitHub and search for RSocket if you're looking for interesting and novel ways to deal with the TCP and interact with it, as Greg pointed out, at a higher level. A lot of them were, a lot of the elements of it were functioning at a higher part of the stack. It's not like Google has the BBR project, which is a rewrite of the TCP stack that behaves in a certain way to optimize and maximize the usage of the data pipe between you and your destination, whatever it is. So it rewrites TCP to leverage that. But this is different from that, if you're thinking it's just something like that. Hmm. Something to poke around at. What else stuck out to you, Greg? Any other major ideas that you wanted to bring up?
I think the other thing was the very big push around APIs. None of these people are talking about – so FutureNet is a conference we've supported pretty substantially for a couple of years now, and we always get visions of what the future is. I think the big thing that I took away from this is that people who think about these things are definitely looking into API-driven networking, software overlays, but also about moving the network stack into the container. So the service mesh to me is much more of a bigger thing about networking connectivity is assumed, and you're just now we're actually talking about services. So the network is a service architecture, not just a.
So there was a highlight to me here. There's an underlay that mostly network engineers think of first, and then there's the overlay. If the underlay is assumed, in other words, delivery of packets is assumed, the interesting bits are happening in the overlay in a variety of different ways. And how do you automate what is happening there? So APIs were a big part of the discussion. Service meshes and that architecture was a big part of that.
Yes, and increasingly the overlay is moving into the app, not actually into a vSwitch. there's sort of a trend there. That's what Istio is trying to do, is actually say, we'll move it into the app itself. So Istio becomes part of the application deployment. Your Kubernetes engine will deploy Istio services automatically. You just configure them and boom, you've got yourself a virtual overlay. It's not even a virtual overlay network, but you're building a network capability that gives you your own visibility without knowing what the physical network is underneath, and no recourse or neither
which
do you
means
care.
That knowing what the underlay is still someone's job and becomes a critical one. One of the things we didn't see was a lot of correlation between underlay and overlay, which there are certain companies that specialize that, and there are some. So I'll give you two examples. One, Big Switch Networks. They have been very good about correlating from underlay to overlay all the way out to app services. That's been one of their core value propositions for a long time now, so that as a network engineer, you know exactly what's going on, soup to nuts, in your network. Now, the other example would be Lightstep. Now, Lightstep's not a networking company. They're a monitoring company that is focused on microservice architectures and helping you understand when your app being delivered by microservices is having a problem. Where might the problem be when you've got this extremely complex interaction between a variety of microservices that make up a single user transaction? They can break down everything step by step by step, what exactly is going on, and help you zero in on the problem. Now, I did a briefings and brief on this some months back. I think it was in 2018 this year. It might have been 2017 anyway. And I talked to, I was talking to a founder or a CTO, something like that. I've forgotten the guy's name. But I asked him, I said, so what about the delivery? What about the infrastructure that's actually delivering these services? And he said, oh, well, we don't really care about that. Now, maybe they've added that as a service, but he made the point, it's the overlay bit. It's the services delivered on top of the infrastructure, on top of the underlay that matters. And so rarely do we have a problem in the underlay that we focus on, you know, the overlay to figure out where the app is slow, to figure out which API call between microservices is having a problem, and then zero in from there, not correlating what's going on underneath. Which takes me back to that original point. Mm. Someone's got to care. Someone's got to understand that underlay intimately.
I do. I just want – and the flip side of this is increasingly LinkedIn was talking about their infrastructure, and their entire networking team consists of 30 people.
Which had grown – what did Zaid say? Yeah. From 4 to 30 over a period of years?
Yeah, that's right. But 30 people is not a lot. So basically a lot of what – today would be handled by networking professionals is now folded in, like they use Kafka and all of their logging information goes into Kafka. So the network engineers aren't responsible for logging, right? It's all taking you reusing what already exists. I'm pretty sure they don't do any of their own cabling or their own racking, right? Somebody else does all that. So I'm taking that into account. But if you still think about that LinkedIn at the sort of size and sale, like it's a $20, $30, $40 billion company, even though it's part of Microsoft, 30 people to run the entire network infrastructure for that business is not a lot of people. And it prompted me to ask the question, how many networking professionals do we need in the future? So if you have products like Istio, where all of the networking services move into the dev/apps layer, and then you have simplified architectural designs in the infrastructure where you just don't need the headcount, how many people will be left in networking in a few years' time?
And I believe you asked that question when you were talking to Guido and Bruce Davies, and Guido may have said, yeah, I don't think there's going to be – we're going to see a reduction in network engineering jobs.
What's hard – I mean, there's going to be some jobs around still for us, and this is one of the things I covered in the career yearbook, because I actually think that networking is a shrinking headcount business, because much of it, automation, artificial intelligence, machine learning, is going to take away some of the jobs. Some of them are going to be replaced with senior, you know, with upskilled jobs. And so if you can upskill and follow the market, then you'll be okay. But I think there's going to be a lot less headcount as we move into the future, because networking just becomes a solved problem. It becomes, to some extent, commoditized. Like, look for example, at HPE SimpliVity and their hyperconverged platforms. They bought Plexi. Plexi has a full network automation system. You don't need to know QoS, you don't need to know connectivity, you don't need to know patching, you just plug it all in once and it's all taken away from you there. Plexi does the whole, and if it needs to be re-architect, Plexi just re-architects the backbone for you. So there's a big change there.
Yeah, but okay, so I'm going to contradict this a little bit. So we're saying network engineering headcount may go down. Okay, I think that's reasonable, because what's happening is the silos are collapsing. And Greg, we know this from talking to a lot of folks. Their job responsibilities are changing. They're not just a network engineer anymore. They're also doing other things. Yeah. And so it's not that the headcount is going away necessarily, but I think the breadth of technology that comes under a person's care and feeding may change. And so the senior folks that are willing to learn things beyond just networking are going to be just fine. And this feels like a conversation we've had several times over the years. I'm not convinced that the need for an IT headcount is going to go away as much as what that IT headcount does is going to be rather different. And so the people right on the edge of retirement who don't want to learn one more bloody new thing, just get out while they can, maybe right up against it. You know, maybe a little tough for them to be stubborn and just stick to the CLI that they know and love. And the folks that have more of a go-getter attitude and really want to keep up with the new stuff will remain employed, just doing different stuff. But I do agree, networking is, well, we've been talking about this for years now. This isn't new. It's happening more slowly than I might have anticipated because networking is complicated. But it is true that the network is being pulled in to all of these other functions, and it goes back to that overlay underlay idea. If you can count on a simple underlay, then put all the interesting bits in the overlay and automate it. Okay, do I need a network engineer for that? I need software for that to do it bloody quick. That's what I need.
But I think I think you also are still going to need networking knowledge because somebody needs to set up your load balancing, set up your micro segmentation properly so that you're actually getting the outcomes you wanted. And yeah, some of that can be automated, but some of it can't. And you also need somebody who's going to know what's gone wrong when there's a problem between the overlay and the underlay, or when this simplified rock solid underlay that you've set up, something does go wrong. So well, I agree that automation is going to probably take away the body count, but the depth of knowledge I think is still going to be required.
I don't remember if it came up with in Zaid's talk from LinkedIn or not, but the idea of the very largest networks, the hyperscale networks, are utterly simple. They are very simple. And that is how they get automated.
The physical networks are utterly simple.
Yes.
The stuff that runs on the top is incredibly complex. Like I've chatted to people from Facebook and LinkedIn and a couple of other of the big ones, and the data that's moving over the top, the people who work in the underlay have no idea what happens above it. And that's why the network is incredibly simple, because everything that sits above the infrastructure changes so rapidly, like deploying live and all that sort of stuff. And I think that that's what I mean about the change in networking. Most often, I think that networking people are there to translate what developers want into what's possible with the infrastructure that you've got. And if we move into the situation where the infrastructure is disaggregated from the app above it, like separated in functionality, then that value disappears. And you either go down to work just on the infrastructure itself and you go very deep and very niche on that, or you go up into the application layer, become like an application networking expert talking about HTTP and SSL and service meshes and how do I map a GCP cloud onto an AWS cloud. In fact, here's one job that I heard of the other day. One guy was telling me that his current job, he was once a senior network architect for a major company, and his job has largely become spreadsheets. And his job is to basically work out how much a cloud network is going to cost on the different cloud providers and work with projects. And he said he's hating it because none of it is networking. And it's all just sitting there trying to calculate how much a cloud network costs, because that's quite difficult to do. And that also is an automatable job, by the way.
We are taking a short break from our episode for some thoughts about our sponsor, Cumulus Networks. Many of you are used to buying a rather closed network. Switches and routers come in boxes. You rack them up, power them on, configure them, and maintain them. And you've done it that way for 20 years. It's your special skill. I mean, sometimes when no one is looking, you walk into the data center, open a cabinet, and pat your favorite switch on its blinking faceplate. No one understands your switches like you do. Well, some bad news. As automation increasingly shows up in the data center, treating your networking gear like favored pets isn't going to cut it. For networking to keep up in an IT environment of constant change, you want a network that you don't have to pat oh so gently on its little CLI head. You want a network that can be configured with the rest of the tools your IT team is probably already using. Enter Cumulus Networks. Now, they don't make switches. They make a network operating system packaged as a Linux distribution, and that Linux distro runs on over 70 different hardware platforms. So you pick the white box switch that you want and then load Cumulus Linux on top. Then you manage your network like you'd manage your servers. Configure the network efficiently using automation tooling just like the server and cloud teams do, and you might even save some money on your budget doing it. Some Cumulus customers have seen as much as a 60% reduction in total cost of ownership, a number likely to impress your boss. Cumulus Networks makes more than just Cumulus Linux, though. They also make NetQ. NetQ is about making sure the network is doing what you want it to be doing. With NetQ, you get to validate your network design, and then if there's trouble, you can troubleshoot that problem more easily via root cause analysis. Will you have to learn a few new skills using Cumulus? Absolutely, and isn't that delicious? It's what technologists are all about, learning new things to keep the organizations they support running at warp speed. For more information, download Cumulus's white paper on transitioning to 100 gig Ethernet at cumulusnetworks.com/100GPOD. That's cumulusnetworks.com/100GPOD. And if you talk to someone at Cumulus to give one of their products a try, tell them you heard about it on Packet Pushers. We would really appreciate that. And now, back to the show.
Well, here's something else also to consider. We talk about the Google networks and the LinkedIn networks, but those are very specialized networks to do a certain number of small tasks, and two, essentially brand new. These were built from the ground up for this purpose. Well, most of the rest of the world is not operating that way. They've got lots of legacy application support, legacy business models. And so what, typically when we talk to customers out in the real world, not to say that LinkedIn isn't the real world, but they're essentially, the new stuff is happening in pods, in little isolated pods, away from everything else that they keep running day to day. So the scale that we're seeing at these big web companies, does that really apply in the automation? Is that really going to, do you think, trickle down to the day-to-day enterprise?
Well, the future's here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. William Gibson.
William Gibson, yes.
So I told the story. I was recently chatting to somebody, and he was telling me that he was concerned about his career because he feels that it's not really going anywhere. And I asked him about his infrastructure, and he said, yes, our entire infrastructure is AS400 running Lotus Notes as a front end.
Sounds like hyperconvergence.
Yeah, like, you know, and you're probably using some sort of thin client for the stuff. And, I mean, that... Well, while that sounds like a horror story to me, that's also, you know, just how far back. That's like 15-year-old technology, maybe further back at this point.
Much further back at this point, yeah.
Yeah, the future's here. It's just not evenly distributed. There's all of it, and there are still some of the biggest companies in the world continue to run mainframes and batch apps instead of this online real-time transaction microservices. So the reality is that while we talk about this advanced stuff, that doesn't mean that you might not be surrounded by another 20 years of ITIL before you go insane. I mean, retire.
I mean, that's the thing. I think, you know, we're talking about microservices and Istio and Envoy and Kubernetes and containers and cloud native applications. And that's great if you're working in that environment, but you're probably also dragging along 20 to 30 years of sunk costs and applications that are running and generating revenue for the business that still have to be run. So,
yeah, good luck convincing the CIO who's just spent $10 million deploying an SAP project or an Oracle project and was expecting to get a 20-year ROI out of it.
Well, you mentioned insanity a minute ago, so let's close out our podcast talking about some personal stuff about our physical health, emotional health, mental health, and how we deal with those things. It's a topic that has come up a lot in the Packet Pushers Network over the off and on over the whole history, but really over the last couple of years especially, we've done a number of shows on it, and we always get emails and tweets back from folks who listened to that, who identified with it, who... It just resonated with them. IT is a stressful job. It's difficult to keep up, and it puts a lot of pressure on all of us that are involved in tech in some way or another. So let's start with physical health, Greg and Drew. I know all three of us here, I think we're some kind of gym goers, exercise getters in some way. Although exercise at the gym does make you grumpy, Greg.
It makes me very grumpy. So one of the challenges I've had is that before I was a packet pusher, you know, before we switched to full time, I was often out. I would fly, leave my house on a Monday and return on a Friday evening, and I'd be away week after week. I'd be out, and then I started working at home, but there was always job pressures, and then there was packet pushes, and I became sedentary, fundamentally attached to a chair. And ultimately, I think that wasn't a mistake as such, but I do feel that in the end, my fitness got to the point where it wasn't working. And particularly, it's become clear to me when we travel, because when I travel, I get tired, really, really tired. And that's my struggle right now, is I need to be fitter to be able to travel and also to be able to concentrate better. So I ended up taking the big bite and paying for a physical trainer. And I actually now go to the gym typically twice a week to be trained. And boy, it hurts.
Yeah, being sedentary is also my, I think, primary physical issue, because I'm at the desk recording or writing or producing or just pumping content through the pipeline, and I'm in a chair doing it. And I've noticed over the years that, you know, things start to hurt, or I'm not as fit as I used to be, or the tummy's getting a little larger, and it's because all day long I'm just in this seat, and so I need to do stuff about that.
Well, Drew, we were in Vegas last week, and you were up at 1 in the morning playing indoor soccer or something. So, I mean, it's not you obviously have a routine and are making some efforts.
Yeah, I mean, I do try to generally stay fit. I do a little jogging. I play some pickup soccer a couple times a week. Occasionally, I do a little bit of light weight training just because I hear that's good for you, and it's good to sort of throw your body a surprise now and then. Yeah, but I think I'm, like most other people, just kind of struggling to put together a fitness program that fits in my schedule and also, you know, just what's interesting. Because if you're trying to do something over and over that's boring, that gets really hard. And Ethan, for you, I know it's hiking, right? That's your physical outlet.
Yeah, hiking's my big thing. I live in New Hampshire in the northeast United States. We have a large national forest up here, the White Mountain National Forest, that's got over 1,400 miles of hiking trails. And right, I go peak bagging and trail bagging and spend my time out there, which really solves. I mean, it certainly helps with a couple of things. So one is, sure, it helps keep me in shape. It helps. I trail run and I hike aggressively is my style.
Like
I
angrily?
Do a lot of miles in a day is the way I like to do things. And so it's taken me a few years to be able to work up to be able to do that. But it helps me with that physical strength. I am still carrying fat from my CCIE study days, which goes back over 10 years now to 2007, 2008. It was during that time that I picked up my weight to be the biggest I ever was, because I was never out of a chair. Either I was in my car going to work, I was at work, or I was at home sitting in a chair studying, and my stress relief was food, and so I packed on a lot of pounds. I still have some of that with me, despite my efforts of exercising and hiking to lose some of it. Mm. So hiking, yes, that's my favorite fun thing to do. Hiking is a fun sport in that you can create lists. I want to go hike all of these mountains, and there's sometimes publicly recognized lists that others people will also try to go and bag those peaks and trails. And so it can be recreational and entertaining in that way, beyond just the fun of getting out there. And I do other stuff too. I do some weight training and things as well. So there's the physical benefit, but then there's also, you know, the mental benefit. I get a break from reading some RFC or some white paper or scrutinizing whatever it is I'm trying to prepare for a podcast, because I'm off in the woods doing something else, having a conversation with someone, or I'm by myself. And I think the physical element is important, but then the mental break is also important. You can't be, or I can't be, what I call on all the time. I can't be always in that mode of intensely concentrating on some difficult task or hard to understand concept without just becoming exhausted. I just can't do it anymore, and I need that break. And physical exercise is a way to get that sort of a break for me.
Yeah. I find walking incredibly tedious because, quite honestly, I get bored. Mm-hmm. So podcasts are something that I've done, and I need to have a destination. So the idea of hiking as a source of fun, that mostly just sounds like FU, not FUM.
And if I took you on some of the trails I go on, that's exactly what you'd say to me several times.
I exactly would, probably before I start, because I'm not dumb. Well, not entirely dumb. I'm going to the gym and I'm getting my, you know, just getting nailed. I'm aching and sore all the time. Now, admittedly, I am 52. I've had probably 10 to 15 years of sedentary behavior. I have been to the gym at different times, but not for a sustained period like I have now. But I tell you what, you know, the most disheartening thing is my weight is not dropping. It's just the same as it always was, even though I'm now more mobile and more flexible and able to lift slightly larger weights than like apple sized. I've moved up from an iPhone sized weight to an iPad sized weight would be a fair summary of my progress, but I do feel better. But generally I just feel hurt. Like I don't sleep after a night of exercise cause everything just aches, which is miserable. I've tried.
It's any consolation. You'll get past that part. I mean, when you do exercise, but it takes a good solid month to two. At least that was my experience of
I'm
getting
six months,
the
dude,
beat I up am, at the gym.
I'm 2 years in and I'm still getting hammered at the gym. It's still not fun. So.
Well, you're not supposed to get hammered at the gym. That's not the way that works.
No, well, no.
You've got to leave the two beer networking at home. That's
yeah. So that's anyway. That's one thing. That's just something I want to – at the end of the day, you have to recognize that you know, staying under a certain weight. I would like to lose a good 10, 20 kilos if that was possible. I don't kill myself over it. I'm not going to beat myself up and set some imaginary goal. For me, it's the journey being – I want more stamina and to be able to sleep better. I don't actually want to lose 10 kilos. That's the wrong goal, in my opinion.
Uh-huh. So what about emotional health then? So physical health is a thing. For me, physical health is tied to emotional health. You know, for me, the big thing is stability. When I'm not doing well, I have this roller coaster of good days and bad days. Good days, I'm happy, I'm on top of the world, I can do all the things. Give me 10 more projects because I'll have them done by tonight because that's how good I'm feeling. Mm. And on the other side, when I'm not feeling emotionally good, it tends to be tied back to how tired I am. Mm. I am a bit depressed. Working alone as I do in my office can be a little depressing at times, and certainly in the winter, since we have winter where I am. You know what I'm talking about, Drew, and you know, oh, Greg, yeah. To some degree, I know you too. You're
yes,
wussy mild winters there in the UK, but you have them nonetheless.
But I think that with the UK, they just sort of live with a perpetual seasonal affective disorder because it's just gray all the time.
That's also true. But my point is, I have, when emotional health isn't good for me, it's that oscillation. I don't sleep consistently well, and that affects my work because my state of mind affects my ability to get things done. And that's been a tough thing for me that I've tried to overcome with going back to the physical aspect, being steady in my exercise, making sure I'm getting out of doors regularly. Harder to do in winter because sometimes it's just too cold and you don't want to go outside for any prolonged period. But it does help stabilize my emotional state. When I'm inside all the time, underneath the office lights, it seems overwhelming. I can't get all the work done that I would like to do. It's all too much. And I'm going to hang out on Twitter and search hashtags and waste time. It's kind of where you end up, you know, because you don't want to do anything.
Yeah,
that's
very true.
And it can get quite lonely. I think one of the biggest things that I've noticed between now as part of Packet Pushes as opposed to the previous stuff is that we talk a lot more. We Slack each other a lot. I don't feel isolated because these chat apps actually help me feel much more attached to people around me. Do you find that?
I personally find that, like, the job I had before, I was also remote. Everybody else was on the West Coast. And so we would have meetings and stuff, but we didn't use video conferencing, which at first I liked, but then over time I just sort of felt like, you know, I'm a disembodied voice coming through a speaker there and they don't really have any sense of me. And it did feel very isolating and alone. So now when we have our weekly meetings, I turn on video because, you know, I want you guys to see me, but I also want to see you, see some facial expressions. It feels like a little bit more connected.
We like to do that so that at least everybody washes once a week.
Well, there's the hygiene element too. Yes. You know,
a wash and a shave once a week's not bad.
That's right. And it is just a headshot. So if I don't want to wear pants, that's an option.
Virtual. You have your virtual pants on.
But now, when I was in an office, we're talking about the disadvantages of working alone and how you overcome that through chat apps and video and so on. But when I was in an office, sometimes it was the opposite thing where it was like, okay, if I have another drive-by by my cube, by a drive-by, I mean someone just cruising the office with coffee who'd see me in my cube and decide they wanted to have a 10-minute chat.
About sports ball.
Oh, about whatever it was. Yeah. I mean, well, sports ball, that's funny. My boss would say to me, okay, Ethan, just so you know, there was a Patriots game, Patriots being a big sports team up here in the area where I live.
I mean, Patriots is an obvious name for a team that chases after balls.
They won the game last night. And the game was a playoff game, so it's really important that happened. And some people are getting super briefed. Excited about that, just so you know. Right, he would brief me like that. I'm like, oh, got it, okay.
Ethan, this is how you be a human in New England.
There's got to be a startup there, like, you know, regional detection, and it sends you an email with the three bullet points about the sports ball that happened.
That is actually the subject of an episode of IT Crowd. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. But that is a plot line, yes.
So, I mean, the opposite can certainly be true as well. But I think in the workplace, you can be just as lonely and isolated too, especially if you're the only one who does what you do. You don't have a team you're a part of. You are the one person in your group that does whatever it is. You take care of all the networking stuff, as it may be. And you have to make the effort then to make some friends and go out for lunch once in a while and not live inside your cubicle unless you're going to the break room for coffee. You got to make that effort, and it can really help.
Yeah. Got to find an outside interest, but it is very difficult, and especially when you're around your family all the time. I think there was a joke somewhere once, somebody said, "I married him for life, but not for lunch. Get out of the house." So if you do work from home, try and find time to get out of the house or give your partner a chance to have some alone time, because living in each other's pockets may work for some couples, but not for every couple, maybe. You
know? Yeah, I think that's true. A little space,
and that's a reality, right? That, let's just face it, that's a reality, which is one.
Now, maybe some of what we've talked about, we're kind of conflating emotional health and mental health. But but Greg, would you're making a distinguishing point between those two. This was these are some of your notes here we're looking at.
Yeah, mental health is slightly different. There is actually physically issues around mental health when you become psychologically unbalanced. Now, sometimes there's a chemical basis to that, like you actually your body stops producing the right chemicals, and you can slip into a depression. Sometimes that depression is caused by brain chemical imbalances, and sometimes it's caused by emotional issues. And there's other times where it just becomes burnout. And then, like, a burnout can be an emotional burnout, or it can actually be a physical burnout where you actually exhaust all of the adrenal resources in your body and you start to collapse. And that's basically, we were talking about this in Vegas, that I'm basically now at the point where I need to take a break. So I need to force myself to take a break. That's the problem, because I'm so, like, packet pushers is so consuming and so requires so much effort to keep it pushed. Like, the fuel of packet pushers is the energy from the team that pushes it along, right? Uh-huh. And there's only so much fuel you've got in that tank before you have to walk away. So I am just about to take a couple of weeks off. So I'm going to go disappearing off into the woodwork as soon as I can nail down some travel.
Yeah, if you book it. Yeah, you better get it booked, my friend, or you're not going to go.
I have my shortlist right here.
Okay.
But yeah, until it's booked, it's not booked. Yes. But you've got it. Sometimes, like, my problem is that I haven't actually had a solid.
I mean, I can follow that up and just make the point of me going hiking, which happens usually once a week, is my version of that. It's a little mini vacation before I mentally disintegrate. Me going out in the woods once a week is pretty necessary. Yeah. I'm also finding that I can't work a 10, 12, 15-hour day every day. I can do spurts of that. But I've got to keep it to, I'm trying to do actually 8 hours or less. I was listening to a podcast this morning where the founder of Dropbox, whose name I'm forgetting, was being interviewed by Tim Ferriss. And that founder of Dropbox, he makes the point that if the only tool in your toolbox is work more, work harder, you're missing, something's wrong. You're missing something. That's not going to solve all the problems for you. And in fact, you might assume that the most successful people in the world is all they do is work and they're working 100-hour weeks. And he said, no, actually, that's not true. When you examine them, they work fairly reasonable weeks and they have time for themselves because that keeps them in the mental state they need to be in to do their jobs effectively. So working harder is not the answer to all of your problems.
Yes. Or working longer.
Right, exactly.
Working hard is fine. I think there's a subtle difference between harder and longer.
Yes.
Working harder in the time available is a smart way to do things, but don't confuse working longer with working harder.
And that's been my strategy, Greg. I've been told you about that. It's like I'm trying to do all the work I need to do in a compressed amount of time, be very efficient during the working hours, get them done, and then switch off and go do something else so that I've got the mental energy to come back again the next day and do it again.
Yeah.
That is way better to me than, well, I got my laptop in my lap, I'm trying to watch Netflix, I'm trying to pet a cat and eat my dinner all at the same time while answering email and planning a podcast. Because I just didn't get it all done today, so now I've got to sit here at night and keep at it. That's not very effective.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think one of the most insidious things that Silicon Valley did was sort of promote this notion that working 60 to 70 hours a week is a measure of your self-worth. I think that whole culture went a long way toward promulgating that. You know, you always read these stories about startup founders who did 100 hours and then they took a nap under the desk and they went back and did another 100 hours. And isn't that amazing? And if you're not doing that, it's because you suck.
I mean, the challenge for me, Ethan, is when I get up in the morning, I'm at my best work at between, say, 8 and 12. And then the problem is that packet pushers, because I live in the UK, most of our clients...
That's when we're waking up.
That's when you're waking up. And then most of our clients are in Pacific time, so we start having meetings from about 4 o'clock. So all of a sudden I've got 4 or 5 hours in the morning, 4 or 5 hours in the evening, and then there's this hours in the middle. What do I do with those? I've only got 4 or 5 hours. I can't... Well, do you know what I mean?
You're networking.
Yeah, well, that was...
We know where that
turning
is.
Up for exactly. a sales call exactly. after two or three beers is not necessarily a good business.
Not choice. A recipe for success.
Not normally, no.
Yeah, I mean, if there's some way we can sum up this conversation, certainly it is the notion of taking care of yourself physically, what your diet and exercise, making time for those things matters because it affects the other areas, emotional and mental health. As well, so making time for exercise matters, and then eating well is a thing that improves your emotional and mental health. And taking care of yourself, I think, also means not giving all of yourself to your employer, whoever that is. Yeah. In the case of us, all three of us are employed by packet pushers. Not killing ourselves to make the company go means we're more effective when we are working on a new podcast or whatever it is that the current project is. And now I worked for a company once, their motto was 100% every day, something to that effect. And it's like, well, if you give 100% of yourself to your employer, what have you got left for the rest of your life? For yourself, for your family,
why are you at work? And it's not for the company, it's for yourself. Yeah.
That's right. So making room for yourself isn't selfish or inappropriate. It's necessary, or you're going to suck at your job eventually because you're going to collapse. You're going to burn out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Take time to think about these things. I raised the topic today because, A, I'm getting my butt kicked by going to the gym regularly and trying to eat healthier, and it's boring and I'm hungry. and because I'm tired and I definitely need a break and I'm planning a holiday. And I think one of the things that we've made a mistake of, perhaps, or I've made a mistake of, is presenting this image of this sort of inhuman sort of machine that just continues to learn and push. And I'm not. I'm just, I'm just doing the best I can. But I'm probably working too hard and I've probably not been balanced as I should be. And this is the thing. I need to take steps now to balance it up. So maybe there'll be a little bit less Greg in the future. How's that?
Well, we'll see what happens.
Haven't booked it yet,
Try to find the balance.
Is that what you're going to tell me? I haven't booked it yet, right?
That's true. You haven't booked it yet. You've told me all about it, and you've done everything but book it. Well, I think we're going to wrap up the show there for today. Thank you for listening to this somewhat introspective, navel-gazy sort of episode. We gave you some insight into what's going on behind the curtains here at Packet Pushers Interactive, a United States company, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you can find the show notes for this episode in your podcatcher if you visit packetpushers.net. We got 1,000 other episodes that are there. Most of them are not this. Most of them are more detailed about networking and infrastructure and nerdy kind of things that you as an engineer would hopefully care about. If you want to write for Packet Pushers, you got some project you worked on and you want to share that with the world, we have a platform for you, a couple of them actually. Packetpushers.net is one. We've got the community blog there. You could write and share and get comments, and thousands of people are subscribed to that feed and are going to read what you have to say. And then we've also got Ignition. So if you have more structured content or something very deep and maybe you want to teach it as a class or share a white paper or something like that, hey, we might even pay you for that content depending on what you have in mind. Let us know. You can email us, packetpushers@gmail.com. Let us know what's on your mind, and we'll work with you to share what you have to say with the rest of the world. If you got something else you'd like to just tell us, you can tweet us at packetpushers. We're on LinkedIn. You can leave comments on some of our posts there. Take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts. We'd appreciate that. That helps make Packet Pushers more visible to the rest of the tech podcasting world. And again, as we mentioned near the top of the show, you can become a premium member now. Support us here at Packet Pushers by going to ignition.packetpushers.net and for $99 a year, becoming a premium member and getting access to that exclusive content. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.